The awareness, I think, is developed through habitual practices. And that means habitually becoming more curious. Like all the tenets of everything I do, whether it's my private work or the group program I do with my partner, is curiosity, kindness, playfulness. So everything I'm doing, I'm asking myself questions. I'm being curious. I'm being in a state of kindness to myself. I'm asking, how playful can this be? And that place of that habitual practice of awareness. Okay, what does this feel like? What other questions can I ask? Am I breathing? You know, what's happening within my body? One of the main practices I give all of my clients is, you know, we have our first call, and then I'll tell them, set your phone alarm, you know, every 2 hours, every day until I talk to you next week. And when that alarm goes off, I want you to pause for 30 seconds and feel what's happening. You know, soften your head from the top, through your face, through your chest, through your stomach, definitely your pelvic floor, because that's where people hold so much tension. And then you're just going to soften and just see what you feel. That's it. You're going to get to know yourself, but it's all habits of awareness. And I think so much that we learn is that it's habits of mental stuff that we need to be aware of. But in reality, once we create habits of paying attention to what's going on more and more subtly, and that's what I do. I just give people practices to go more and more and more inward, so they know themselves better and better and better. It just becomes more habitual. We just start to have a deeper awareness, just habit. I've said that like 50 times already, but it's creating habits of, instead of thinking through everything and valuing our mind so much, it's actually beginning to value all the other parts of ourselves. And that becomes a habit.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Kelly, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Yay, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so I was referred to you by one of our mutual friends who had nothing but amazing things to say about you. And she said that you and I had to talk. And given that she has referred many interesting guests herself, I thought, yeah, this is kind of a no-brainer. So I want to start by asking you, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on your life and your career and the choices that you've made?
I am not completely clear what group I was part of, because I seem to have been part of a little part of everyone. Is that I had this ability to float through every group. I have friends. I always had friends in every group in high school. So I always felt a little bit like I was the outsider, but the insider. Mm-hmm. I was able to, you know, meet up with the new kid that felt awkward. I was accepted as the cool kid. I was an athlete, so I got along with the athletes. I was a little bit nerdy, so I got along with the nerds. I really did get along with everyone. And I think I was just talking to a friend about this, that the thread that's run through my whole life is that I'm a bridge for people. I take what's inconceivable or something valuable that they can't quite put into their own life, and I link that for them. I have this common language, and that's the same way that I've moved through. You know, I lived in Santa Barbara, and I worked with really wealthy people, some really wealthy people. But I've also worked on projects where I worked with homeless people and mentally ill people, and I'm able to move through different socioeconomic status and all different social groups. And I think it was impacted by my high school years. Yeah.
So several questions come from that. One, what sport did you play? Just out of curiosity, you mentioned you're an athlete.
Oh yeah. I was a gymnast. I became a gymnast when I was like 4 and a half. And I was a gymnast all through high school until I had a back injury in my junior year. And I became the captain of the gymnastics team at that point. But then I started diving, because diving is a natural extension. It was something that didn't hurt my back. And then I did that a little bit in college as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What lessons did you take away from the athletic aspects of what you did in high school that you have found have been applicable to your life?
Oh my gosh. I would say the number one thing, well, first of all, I mean, the health and wellness element of that, the health of my body is directly related to my emotional health, my mental health, everything. It's all related. And one is not more valued than the other. So that was a huge thing. Being a gymnast is all about discipline and moving through discomfort. I think what was interesting is, so I learned that really well. I am driven. You know, when I decide I want something, I go for it. But I have to really want it. If I don't want it, I don't want it. You cannot compel me. I can't want to want it. So it's really interesting. When I'm driven, I'm driven. And I think that came from the discipline of being a gymnast. Mm. The other thing I learned from it was that relates to my current life is I learned to not listen to myself to some degree, because you have to know your body. You're the one running it. You know, you're the one who's going to get hurt. On the other hand, I also listened to signals that I got from the outside to push past my tolerance and past my pain. So it's fascinating that created injury, but it's also created my successes. So yeah, I think it was really vital to my development as a human, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So
that ability to be a bridge, you know, it's funny. I find that as one of the common patterns that I've seen between a lot of people that I've interviewed, their ability to sort of navigate multiple social uh-huh. groups, or even if they were outcast, suddenly they're connected to just a set of people that they probably never could have imagined themselves connected to when they were in high mm-hmm. school. I'm curious if each group in particular taught you something about human behavior and relationships, and if so, you know, what did you learn from each group?
Yes. Well, one of the things that happened as I started traveling, as soon as I could, I was in my early 20s, I started international travel. And I think that's what happened was I found people so interesting in all these different groups, but there was a common thread. People really are the same. And we really have the same desires for connectedness and being loved and being loving and being ourselves. And I saw that everywhere. And then I'd see it overseas. I saw it with really impoverished people and super wealthy people of all different nationalities, colors, race, size. And so I think what I learned in high school was that when I could look beyond, because I wasn't so attached to being the cool kid, I didn't have an attachment to my identity as that or being anyone in particular, I got to really see the commonalities. And so to me, I saw the behavior that would happen in each of those groups. So say the cool kids might be mean to the nerds. So what I would see is like this defensiveness, this attachment to their identity because they wanted to be okay. They wanted to be enough. And then I would see maybe another group of kids, I hate to label them, but like another group of kids really, really trying to fit in. It was the same driving force was, I want to be loved. I want to be enough. And so I think each group I could look at them and like see this with this x-ray vision. Just see through the behavior and the external and see that the internal drive was similar. Mm-hmm. Then I think what happened as an adult going out and working with, I grew up in the middle class family and my family came from, you know, my parents were super young when they had me, they were like 19 and they had to grow into having a career and having money. So then I go and I start working in San Francisco and Santa Barbara and I'm working with really wealthy people. And then I worked with really poor people and I started to see that none of the external stuff still yet again defined us. It all came from within, and the people that were internally aware were actually the ones that could move through the world with so much more ease. Mm. So that was kind of what I found. I hope that's clear what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
You
know, something that you mentioned, you talked about it, you said this phrase over and over, so there's no way I could mm-hmm. let go of it, was this notion of attachment to identity. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that our attachment to identity continues well into adult life. It's only when we can sort of dissociate or disconnect those two things that we open up a lot of possibilities because we have, you know, so many labels that we identify with. So I think I've shared this on a stage before. It's like, I hate the term podcaster because it's so limiting and right. there's so much more that anybody who tells stories in this medium can do. And I realized, you know, if you identify with labels, you actually limit your capacity. I'm curious how you disconnect attachment to an identity so that it doesn't become one of those things that consumes or limits you.
Yeah. Well, the first thing about that is I think, you know, I've worked with elders and I would watch how that actually progressed way late in life. So I think it's part of the human experience is the possibility of letting go of all attachments. I actually think that's enlightenment is the reduction of all resistance and all labels and attachments. It allows you to be so expansive, it becomes enlightenment. And so for me, that looking at, well, how do we let go of that? the first thing when I'm recognizing my attachment to something is, one, I'm way up in my head. It has nothing to do with how I feel in my body. It doesn't have anything to do with all of the other parts of me. It's very mental and heady that I'm attached, and it's driven by fear. And so if I can think to myself, Kelly, you're really attached right now that someone, like, I have an attachment, not so much anymore, but I did not want to be called a coach because it felt like anyone could go and for $200 sign up and become a coach and start infusing themselves in people's lives. And I felt like, God, I have 20 years of experience. I'm not, quote unquote, just a coach. And all of that was my attachment to the labels. I was resisting my potential, my possibility, because I didn't want to be known as a coach. Now I don't care what you call me. But it was me looking at, what am I afraid of here? I'm afraid that people won't see my true, like, who I am, that I'm absolutely this vast, amazing being. So I wanted to resist that label. I mean, also, I might put a label on myself because I want people to see me as a certain way. Like, I might say, oh, I'm so amazing at this because I want to convince you that I'm amazing. It's because I'm afraid. Like, what if you don't think I'm amazing? What if I'm not amazing? So I always have to ask myself, what am I afraid of with this label? Why am I so attached to this? And that curiosity just triggers, for me anyway, and I find for most of my clients, an awareness. And then we can just kind of sit back for a second and think, oh, wait, I don't need that label. We might have to do that over and over and over again to let go of our labels because they're just habits we have of the mind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. Well, speaking of what you do, walk me through how you actually get to what you do. You know, what have been sort of the significant inflection points of your career, and what has been the trajectory of it?
Yeah. So I, out of high school, I started working, not out of high school, out of college, I started working in healthcare, and I realized very quickly that I really loved people dynamics. And I always have. I remember when I was super young, out in the backyard in the woods, being fascinated by the world and by people, but never being part, feeling like I was in a group. I'm kind of an anomaly. I never wanted to get married. I've never wanted children. I don't have any desire to own a home. I just like to explore moving through the world. And it's been like that for a long time. So when I got out of college, I went into healthcare. I started loving talking to people and the diversity of people that would come into the hospital. And I thought that was really interesting. And then when I moved, I needed a new job. So I walked into this place. It was an elder care community. And I walked in. It was a small town. And she hired me. And I, within 6 months, they moved me into an executive management position, which shocked the heck out of me. So by 26, I became an executive manager running a place that had, you know, 30 plus employees. I had 100 people living there. I was connected with the community. Actually, that was in Santa Barbara. So I was connected with the outer community. A lot of influencers were invested in this project I was working on. And I started loving, quote unquote, managing and leading people. And that led to people asking me, will you come and, you know, do this at my place? Teach me and our team how to have this cohesive, fluid, happy team. You know, your people are happy. And that led to me doing consulting. And then what I learned was I really love the one-on-one exploration with someone, because when you have an influencer you're working with and they can expand into this place of knowing themselves and being really fulfilled, it's like this natural process happens. Their leadership excels and they ripple that out to everyone around them, their business, their friends, their family, and everything becomes more fulfilling. So that was like the trajectory that led me to here now, where I work with pretty much successful people have checked all the boxes and they've gotten to this place where they're asking the questions. The things I hear most are, there's got to be something else here. What else is there? I'm so smart, but why does this not feel totally fulfilling? Or this isn't enough, where people have worked really hard, they're really smart, and then they're wondering, you know, this isn't enough. There's got to be something else going on here that I can create in the world that will make more impact. So, yeah.
Think the concept of unmistakable, making things so distinctive that your competition becomes relevant, would be inspiring to employees or attendees at your company event or conference? If so, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking to learn more, submit your contact info, and we'll be in touch.
So you said you worked with people who are elderly, and I'm curious, what are the things that you heard from them that they said they wish they knew when they were younger that you have found to be really informative life lessons?
Oh my gosh, it changed my life. It makes me so sad that our culture doesn't embrace elders so much more, because, you know, being 26, running this place and having 100 elders around me, they would constantly give me teachings. And the primary one was, don't wait. Go travel, leave this secure job, live life, you know, be happy. They just would I would constantly have these people telling me that, don't wait, honey. We did this, you know, we waited and worked till we were 65 and then we couldn't even go on that big trip we wanted to do. Or don't stay with that guy. A lot of women said to me, you know, don't stick out something that's not really fulfilling. They constantly planted these seeds for me of like, kind of societal rebellion, actually, to just do it your own way, follow the thread of what you want to do. And yes, it completely changed my life, because that I heard those voices with every move that I made. I heard those voices. If this isn't fulfilling, how can you evolve it to either be fulfilled or shift direction a little bit, change course, move where you'll actually experience life more fully. Oh my gosh. Yes. They gave me so many lessons.
You know, something else that really struck me it was something you said about not wanting kids, not wanting to get married. And what it made me think is that, you know, these are all deeply embedded social programs that you haven't necessarily given into. And I'm curious why that is. And more importantly, how people undo social programs that aren't necessarily serving them or aren't necessarily what they want.
Yeah. So a lot of people were coming to me a couple years ago because I had written a couple posts about make your own rules. And that was, surprisingly, that was really compelling to people. And yes, I don't know. Part of it, I feel like just from a young age, I wanted to explore this idea of what would be really fulfilling. And so I really just questioned when people would say to me, you know, about getting married or about having kids. And I would just wonder, like, why? I would just get really curious, not from a mental place, but from an embodied state. Like, if I get married to this person, what is going to happen that's going to be different from where I am right now? And I just kept following the thread of curiosity. I think that is really the thing that also with, you know, with the people I work with, when they're saying to me, they're regurgitating back the things they've heard and their fear of moving out of those social norms, even though they have a desire to, I usually just take them back to themselves and ask them to get really curious. How would that feel? What would happen? Is that really true? And just kind of pointing back within. And it's not a mental practice. Again, this is very much a sensorial practice, because when we sense what's going on in our body, which I will say 99% of people don't know what they're feeling in their body. We have very gross awareness of our physical body. When we start feeling the sensations, the subtle sensations in our body, all of a sudden we have this whole other relationship with ourselves. We go from being like a one-dimensional human who's very mental, moving through the world, following the suggestions we're giving, to this multidimensional person that sits back and I get more present with myself. What do I think about that? What do I feel about that? What would the results of that be? And then I'm the kind of the cheerleader that says, go for it, try it, experiment. Experiment's one of my favorite words, curiosity and experiment, because there's no end game here. You just, like, everything I've done, I've tried year after year, like not having children, right? Everyone tells you as a woman that you're going to want to have kids. Oh, well, when you turn 30, it's going to happen. When you turn 35, when it's going to happen. And I said, okay, every year I'll be available to that. And I'll be curious if that's true for me or not. And it never came true. I'm 43 now. I never have had a desire enough to raise a child. Never had a desire enough to get married, even though I'm in a long-term committed relationship, which is easy and joyful and fun. But I just constantly get curious beyond my mind. What would that feel like? What would that be like? Is that really true?
Yeah.
No. Curiosity.
So something else you said earlier in our conversation is, you know, rich or poor, you know, at the top of their game or not, there's a sort of internal awareness that has to be developed before we get to a point of really being fulfilled. And I'm curious, how is that awareness developed? And for you, how has that awareness changed with age?
Yes, the awareness has changed a lot for me. The awareness, I think, is developed through habitual practices. And that means habitually becoming more curious. Like all the tenets of everything I do, whether it's my private work or the group program I do with my partner, is curiosity, kindness, playfulness. So everything I'm doing, I'm asking myself, questions. I'm being curious. I'm being in a state of kindness to myself. I'm asking, how playful can this be? And that place of that habitual practice of awareness. Okay, what does this feel like? What other questions can I ask? Am I breathing? You know, what's happening within my body? One of the main practices I give all of my clients is, you know, in the first, we have our first call, and then I'll tell them, set your phone alarm, you know, every 2 hours, every day until I talk to you next week. And that, when that alarm goes off, I want you to pause for 30 seconds and feel what's happening. You know, soften your head from the top, through your face, through your chest, through your stomach, definitely your pelvic floor, because that's where people hold so much tension. And then you're just going to soften and just see what you feel. That's it. You're going to get to know yourself, but it's all habits of awareness. And I think so much that we learn is that it's habits of mental stuff that we need to be aware of. But in reality, once we become, create habits of paying attention to what's going on more and more subtly, and that's what I do. I just give people practices to go more and more and more inward, so they know themselves better and better and better. It just becomes more habitual. We just start to have a deeper awareness, just habit. I've said that like 50 times already, but it's creating habits of, instead of thinking through everything and valuing our mind so much, it's actually beginning to value all the other parts of ourselves. And that becomes a habit.
You know, another thing that has been really on my mind lately, I think it's because of a 40th birthday coming around the corner, is why we think so much that, why are we so addicted to this idea that it is going to be something external that creates a shift internally for us? And it seems that we believe that, even though we know that that is not true. On some level, I think there are certain things that I still think, okay, yeah, that will make me feel differently if I have that one thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's partly just human nature, because I think everywhere I've ever gone, in every culture, there's a degree of this, that external, whether it's people are trying to fit into a cultural norm within their small family dynamics, and their, so that's some external stuff, or whether it's here where we think, you know, if I just, you know, I'm like that guy that makes all that money and has all that stuff, he looks so happy, let me be like that. Like, if I get there, then I'll be that. I actually think it's because we just create habits in our mind, and we buy into it. We believe what our mind says, and our subconscious mind is really designed to keep us safe and familiar. So once those patterns begin, our mind is just constantly looking for what's safe and familiar here. It's not a very complex, smart thing that it does. So we have to be able to, I call it like the big K, the big me, the conscious part of me has to look at my mind and see I'm not my mind. My mind has this function, and what it does is it keeps me safe and familiar. So I'm constantly looking for safe and familiar. And when everybody's told me that, you know, get the secure job and make the money and have the beautiful body and all this external stuff's going to make that happen, my subconscious mind is like, Kelly, do that, do that, do that. You know, and then we just keep getting the messages, and we just have to make some choices at some point. There's a decision. I'm going to trust. That's not true. I have to take a risk at some point to know that, wait, these little signs that I'm getting inside, these little messages, that's more of the conscious me that's saying, that's not really true. I've been doing this for 10, 20 years and it's not working. I don't feel any more satisfied. So why is that still true? It's just my mind saying it. So I think that's, like, for me, that was the first thing that ever happened. You know, I'd known, I trusted myself. So there's some knowing there, but I created this awesome external life, traveling all over, living this amazing lifestyle that people were like, how did you create that? So by my late 20s, I had all of this external awesome going on, right? Living on beaches, by premier surf spots, beautiful houses, sailing the ocean, working part-time, having money in the bank. I mean, pretty much by my 20s, I was like, all right, this is it. Like, I've done this. Like, this is what people have been telling me we need to do, right? So I'm so grateful that I saw that. And then I really had to go within. And I kind of tossed it all out. I said, what would happen if I didn't do all that? And I just listened to myself. And I took the risk that I could lose everything, that people won't like me, that I won't make money. But I'm going to sit my butt down and I'm going to listen to that internal part of me that transcends the barrage of daily mind stuff that goes on. And then, and I actually did a long silent retreat, and that was pretty transformational because I actually saw, it's like, oh my God, my mind is telling me all kinds of stuff. It's just nonsense. But that transcendence, now every day I'm in the world, right? I'm talking to you. I have this business. I meet with all these people. My mind is activated all the time, but I have to be conscious that my mind is going to lead me to familiar and comfortable all the time. So I have to make choices, like moments to moment. What's true here? You know, what do I really want to feel here? You know, and I know that the external is not going to be satiating. It's fun. It's awesome. But it's not going to fulfill that place in me that is like easy and joyful and loving and kind. I can get that when I got nothing around me. I don't need anything to have that. Just cultivating it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Hey, it's Srini, and I just want to say thanks for listening. If you're finding our show inspiring or thought-provoking, the biggest thing that you can do to support us is to share the show with someone else who you think would find these conversations valuable. And with most podcast apps, you can just send a link via text. Thanks again for listening to the show. So one of the other things you mentioned is that you spend a lot of time consulting with people on building happy and effective teams. And I'd like to spend some time talking about that, how we do it, how we bring it into our organizations, and how it applies to our lives.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that I think internal awareness is the thing that I think most of the time we go into business, right? I was actually just talking to Fran Hauser about this, who just wrote the book, wrote a book about women being, you know, nice and powerful, kindness and powerful. And we were just saying, oh my God, that's so true. And part of it is that we have to be self-aware as leaders. And then everyone on our team gets to be self-aware. There's so much fear in organizations, I think, that if I'm my real self, if I soften and I'm present and I'm available, it won't be enough that I'm going to lose my job, that my boss won't like the way I'm being. So what it does is it drives us to be like performing for someone else, which is the external thing. So what I love to do when I would go in was really, and people don't like this at first because they want you to be very mental. Give me the steps. Tell me what to do. But that's only theory. And so I would give them physical practices to be aware of. I would give them awareness practices that the whole team had, that there was a commonality. So for instance, I do this 4 steps to transparent communication. And it's really awesome when you implement it with a team. Everyone's on the same page. So what I would do it with the leader would have the one-on-one time with me. We would walk through all these scenarios of how you're going to use this and actually be transparent with your team in a way that's powerful. And then I would meet with the team and then we would do it with them. And then all of a sudden and then I would be out of the picture and the leader and the team is doing it together. They're growing together. They're being aware of themselves. And I think that's a really key thing that's missing is that work is our greatest opportunity to explore ourselves, how we show up in a conversation. What do we do with conflict? You know, what happens when we, you know, where do we limit ourselves creatively because we're afraid it needs to fit into a certain box? But when we do these awareness practices, we start to identify where that is. And when you do that with a team, all of a sudden they're becoming more self-responsible with what they're feeling and their awareness. And then they can express themselves. Well, I'm feeling really uncomfortable right now. I've hit a wall. I'm afraid to be super creative because I'm afraid it won't fit into your box of what you're looking for. What can we do here? You know, it becomes this transparent awareness around what we're feeling and being responsible for ourselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So you mentioned the 4 steps to transparent communication. I was wondering if you could actually walk me through what all of those are.
Yeah. So the first step is having an intention. One of the things I realized when I started talking to teams was most people have absolutely no intention when they start talking. So they don't know why they're even talking. They're just talking out of discomfort usually to get some resolution that they don't know what they want. So the first step is have an intention for every conversation and interaction. You know, what do you want to create from this? The second is be direct. And that is get to the point. Don't confuse and convolute the conversation because you're uncomfortable. So go right to the point of what you want to create here. The third is, and I could go into this way more, but the third is transparency. This is the one that is most challenging for people because we learn not to be transparent. And the transparency is what I just said in that conversation. Like, hey, I'm a little, what I'm noticing is I feel afraid or I feel really uncomfortable right now about this. I'm not totally clear why, but I want to do this. And can we talk about this? I know I'm just throwing this out there right now, but the transparency is I'm going to bring my full self to the conversation. I'm going to tell you what I'm feeling. This is the same in romantic conversations. You know, you tell your partner something and you're like, I'm really uncomfortable about this conversation. I'm really excited about this. And then you're on the same page. They know why we're having this conversation. They know where you are. They're not guessing. What is he trying to get out of this? You know, where is he at right now? I don't know. And then the fourth one is just a safety valve. And that is, the fourth one is, be kind. If you're intentional, you're going to be kind. If you're direct and transparent, you're going to be kind. But when people are learning how to be transparent, because most of us don't know, and I really have to walk through people examples over and over, then they have to remind themselves, wait, is this a kind? Am I being kind right now? Or am I just being direct? Like, being honest is not direct and transparent sometimes. It's just mean and harsh, you know? So those are the four steps: intention, direct, transparent, kind. Mm. Yeah.
So
changes everything.
Why do people come to you? And what are they trying to accomplish? And two, what is the difference between the people who actually produce the results that they want in their lives as a byproduct of working with you and the ones who don't?
Yes. Okay. So the people I work with have really gotten to that place where they're curious, right? They're usually really smart. So they've been really great at creating stuff in their lives, whether that be work, lifestyle, success in business. And then they've gotten to this moment when the external is not enough, or the projects they're working on, they get the sense, this hit, that there's more to this and I can't see it. Like, I don't know what else, but I have the sense. I can't think my way there. It feels too hard. And usually those are my people. They're always questioning. There's got to be something else. There's got to be more. But they're not just tired. So this is where the difference is. They're not just tired of it that way. They have a curiosity about things. The second thing you said, what gets the people that get most results with me, right? The fastest, I tend to only work with people in the 6 month range, because things can happen really fast when someone is, this is where the creativity comes in, is when someone has a relationship with that creative flow, they can very quickly get what I'm talking about. They can very quickly implement these practices I give them into every area of their lives. Because I think when we've accessed creative flow, and I tend to work with a lot of people that have a creative angle on their business, they're like creative professionals, when they've had that moment of, I'm completely immersed and everything's flowing through me, they are present to like the highest degree. And so when that presence happens, then I can help them take that and translate it to every area. And when they do that, they start getting the answers. They just start knowing, oh, this is the next project. This is what's fulfillment's going to look like for me. But it's usually they have to have creative. I've worked with super mental, mindy, intellectual people, and it takes longer if they don't value the creative process. Uh-huh. Because they can't feel it. It's like they can't feel like the flow of, oh yeah, when I'm doing this project, I'm kind of lost in the moment and all the answers come and I know the color and I'm going to try this. It's just so similar to removing all these other resistances and barriers. Yeah.
Hey, it's Srini. I've created a swipe file of my best creative strategies, which I've used to write multiple books and hundreds of blog posts. Follow it and you'll kill your endless distractions, do more of what matters to you in higher quality and less time. Just visit unmistakablecreative.com/productivityguide to download it for free today. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/productivityguide.
Yeah. So I'm a huge believer in the power of flow, just written a book about this. And it's a big part of what I spend my time thinking about and how I want to spend time every day. One of the things, it's funny because I'm this really bizarre combo, I think, of both of the types of people that come to you, in that I always want evidence to back up everything. I want logic behind it. I want science behind it. So I'm curious, how do you quantify something like what you're talking about?
Meaning results wise, or tell me, what am I quantifying?
Yeah, results.
So the results that I quantify are usually what the clients get out of it. I follow the thread of, so I'm super mindy too. And usually that's, my clients are like you, because I'm not super woo. I might talk about energy and flow and all this, but I really get down to the physical body. I'm going to tell them this is evidence-based because you're going to feel a difference. That's really, for me, what's quantifiable, is that when I have someone come to me, like I have this new client, she's very mindy. very intellectual, but she has a storytelling branding business, which is amazing, right? So she comes to me, and over 1 month, she starts telling me, I've felt more in my body. I've been more present than I've ever been in my whole life. That's what I use as quantifiable. Someone who says to me within a couple months, I've never felt this happy in my whole life. Like, for me, they're not like scientific quantities, but they're more evidence-based of, you know, the better I get at providing these tools and the more present I am, the better I get at seeing the fastest way for someone to feel it. And that's what I use as evidence. Like, my evidence is that the clients tell me they're getting results and they keep sticking with me until they're done.
Yeah.
So
what are some of the things that have happened in people's lives as a byproduct of this work?
Oh yeah. Well, for one, I mean, everything logically from, I have someone who came to me and had a 5-year business, like in 5 years, she was going to launch this amazing thing. And within our first meeting, just through me giving her some practices, she started the project that next week. And within a year she had launched the business and she's creating an impact. I mean, just that kind of, you know, that immediate impact of getting out of her way very quickly because she started feeling what she was feeling and where her resistance was. Another person is, what's fascinating is a lot of my clients have interpersonal wins that translate to business. So someone told me they hadn't spoken to their teenager in like 10 years, barely. She's like, I'm with him all the time. I talk to him all the time. I don't understand why he doesn't want to talk to me. I'm the one doing all the talking. Give her a practice. And then I told her, just do this practice. Next week, she came back to me, tears in her eyes, because she said he talked to me more in the last 10 years than he, I mean, in the last week than he has in the last 10 years. Other clients having numerous transparent communications with their partner, lover, husband, and business, where all of a sudden they remove all the resistance to everything. They've been holding all this resistance to having conflict or fear of saying what they thought. But once they were just more self-aware, they had these direct conversations. When you can have clear communication, everything starts to change. You know, people making more money because they didn't fear asking for it. They didn't have any story wrapped up and around it. They just have the conversation and they ask for it. They talk about it. They get what they want from their romantic partners and their business partners. So it's fascinating because it's all these subtleties. It starts rippling out with like, well, who are you hanging out with now? I'm hanging out with most of the people I want to hang out with. They inspire me. And that's because they started looking at how do they feel? What do they want to be like? Who do they want to be around? And that is, you know, relationship and business. It's all related. Mm. Like who we are, I forget who said this, but who we are anywhere is who we are everywhere. People read us all the time. So when you start being more present, people want to be around you. So all these opportunities start to arrive. Yeah. And that's actually one of the things is I would say the clients go from threat assessment to opportunity assessment. They're really going from looking at the world and how do I need to react to this to get what I want to what's available here for me. And I think that's why they get the opportunities for new business partnerships or, you know, whatever, making more money or creating a new project in a way they didn't see before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my clients is working on a legacy project that she thought was very clear to her, but I asked her to pause on it. And we've been doing some of this work. It's completely taken a different direction. The foundation is the same, but the way it's going to show up in the world is totally different, way bigger.
How do you make that shift from threat assessment to opportunity assessment? And I'd imagine it's probably a delicate balancing act too, right? Because you don't want to be completely unaware of the threats that exist. So for example, if you have the potential threat of running out of money, I think you'd want to know that about a business.
Oh yeah. So that's actually one of the things we always talk about is black and white thinking. So you don't have to be in threat assessment or only be in opportunity assessment, or I should say that differently, is that when we're in threat assessment, we think we have to be looking for threats. When you start to move and you start to become aware that, wait a minute, I will always be looking for what's going on. When I'm in opportunity assessment, it doesn't mean I'm only seeing good. It's not like I have these rose-colored glasses on, like the world is all great. No, no, no. Opportunity assessment is the finest, highest level of presence. So when I'm able to see opportunities, I'm also seeing what's actually happening. I'm in quote unquote reality because I'm actually seeing everything the way it is. And so if there's a problem, if there's something, if there's a challenge that arises, I'm so much more highly present to look for opportunities for resolution rather than reacting to the financial distress I'm in. Because when I react to financial distress, I'm not at my highest level of functioning. I don't even see opportunities. I'm just like, oh my God, what's the resolution? Let me find the thing that's going to work within what I already know. And that is the subconscious mind, familiar and safe. So it's like we have opportunity assessment just means I'm going to be so freaking present that I see everything that's available. So when I'm low on funds, all of a sudden I see new possibilities I never would have seen before. And then I can choose something that's the most opportune, the most resonant with the needed solution. So it's not that you put on the rose colored glasses and pretends everything's all great. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so I want to finish with two final questions, and this is a question that I have been asking very randomly just based on a recent article I wrote that seemed to have picked up a lot of steam and became quite popular. What do you think we should have learned in school but never did?
Oh my gosh, who we are. I feel like we are moving through the world limiting ourselves constantly. We don't even know who we are. So when we say be yourself, people don't even know what that means. They're like, who am I? I don't know. In school, if we had awareness of what we felt and what we were, you know, all of our capacity, it would change everything. If I knew all of this when I was in school, I would be completely different. If you and I both learned awareness when we were in school, the choices we made thereafter would be different. We'd be so much quote unquote smarter. We'd be so much more optimized.
Wow.
I think we know more than we know. We just like when people are like, I don't know. I think you already do know. We know our true nature is highly awesome. It's highly refined and tuned. We just have all this layering of stuff on us that limits it. And that's it. When we let go of it, we already are amazing. That's what I wish we learned in school.
Wow. So I have one last question for you, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Presence. You know, I thought about this question last night and I thought, be yourself. But given what I just said to you, I think we all want to be ourselves, but I think the way to be ourselves is to become more present with ourselves and know who we are. So we're not just regurgitating back stuff we've heard or we should say to be accepted. When I'm really present with who I am, that's when I really attract people. And when I'm around people that are really present, I'm so interested in them. I want to know more about them. I'm like, oh, who is this person? There's something about them. Makes them resonant. So yeah, presence.
Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
You can come see me on Facebook because I love posting on Facebook. But also kellysheets.com is my website. And go there and I give out these free 45-minute calls and I give everyone one tool that will help them so that they can have a sense of what this stuff that I'm talking about is to bring it into reality. So yeah, kellysheets.com is the easiest way to find me.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.